Right, welcome everybody. We, as I say, we've had a lot of people sign up to this one, which is wonderful. This is a CAGNY event. I am Sally Pavey. I'm chair of CAGNY, and on behalf of the CAGNY committee, welcome to this event. Ask questions of the head of airspace and strategy and engagement at Gatwick Airport. CAGNY is your umbrella aviation and community and environment group for Sussex, Surrey, and Kent. We are a voluntary group. We are reliant upon donations. And if this session is of a help to you, we would ask you to perhaps donate to us via our website, which is cagney.org. If you're a member, you will know that we ask for an annual subscription of £4, but it is not obligatory. Obviously, any funds that we receive do not go to committee members in expenses. They go towards running of CAGNY for the Zoom account, the website, leaflets, etc. And many of you may have met us talking to you out and about. So I'm going to move on, but before I introduce our guest speaker in the hot seat tonight, I'd like to offer you the following. Now, I want to enable as many of you as possible to ask questions, but to try and assist with that, I'm going to try and put it into four categories. So they're all obviously relating to Gatwick airspace. So the first category will be airspace concerns today. So if you can try and theme your questions, and can you please enter them into the chat? I will try and call upon as many of you as possible, but if there is a theme going on in the questions in the chat, I'll try and summarize so that we try and get through as many questions as possible, because I'd like to do that this evening for you. The second section will be on night flights. I know that is a major concern for a lot of people. The third section will be on the second runway, and all that entails. And the last session will be on the modernisation of airspace, known as FASES, but basically the redesigning of the airspace. So for us, it's Gatwick Airport and Heathrow. So they're the four categories. If you can try and theme your questions, I know it's difficult, but put them in the chat and I'll endeavour to get to you as many as possible. So I'm now going to not waste any more time. I now welcome our guest speaker, Head of Airspace Strategy and Engagement, Andy Sinclair at Gatwick Airport. And we have to thank him for joining us tonight. He actually did an event on Tuesday night for elected members. And so we're delighted that he has agreed to do a public event. And obviously, we host things online because it reduces the emission of everyone trying to travel to a venue. And it also enables everyone to be able to be at home, whether it be in Sussex, Surrey, or Kent, and attend these meetings. So I have an opening question because there isn't anything in the chat. So remember, the first section is airspace concerns today. And I've got an opening question that has been sent in. Now, please get your questions in the chat room. Give me an idea of where you live, because that will help Andy in his responses to you if they're about specific issues that you are currently witnessing or what you're concerned about in your area. So give us a clue to where you live. Right. So the first question I have for you, Andy, is, I'm a resident of Southwater. When the wind is in the east, why do arrivals fly directly over Southwater and Billingshurst at a height of between 4,000 and 6,000 feet?
Thanks, Sally. And thank you for the invitation to come and answer people's questions tonight. I'm assuming that you're talking about arriving aircraft coming in and the wind coming from the east, so what we call runway 08. So just to be clear for everybody, those less familiar, depending on the direction of the wind, that dictates how the runway is used. So if the runway is coming From the east, we use what we call runway 08, and that means arrivals approach from the west of the airport. And if the wind is coming from the west, aircraft take off towards the west on what we call runway 26, and so they arrive from the east of the airport. So the reason I think what you're talking about, Sally, is the approach profile that arrival aircraft take as they approach the airport. So the way aircraft land at the airport is using something called the instrument landing system. So that's essentially a system that fires out from the runway onto the extended centerline. And generally during the day, aircraft pick up the instrument landing system between roughly 8 nautical miles and 15 nautical miles from the airport. And a nautical mile is a little bit longer than a statute mile. So the way air traffic control works, I should say that NATS provide air traffic control services at Gatwick. So I'm a little bit talking on their behalf, if you like. When arriving aircraft come to Gatwick, they'll fly through or spend some time in the hold at Gatwick. And there are two holds just to the southeast and the southwest of Gatwick. Now, depending on the altitude pressure setting, the aircraft will leave that hold or fly through the hold at 7,000 or 8,000 feet. And what the air traffic controllers try to do is provide a profile for that aircraft to safely join the instrument landing system extended center line. So like I said earlier, roughly between 8 nautical miles and 50 nautical miles from the airport. So when the aircraft leave the hold, they'll be given what's called track distance miles to run. So that's how far those aircraft have got to fly before they reach the touchdown point. So the controller passes that piece of information as the aircraft exits the hold. And let's say that's about 26 nautical miles. And then the pilot will aim to fly the aircraft in a way that optimizes its glide profile. So it arrives at the ILS center line at about 3,000 feet, depending on what range it is from the touchdown point. The controller helps that by giving that track miles to run at that initial point. And then a bit later on, the controller will probably send, we call that the INC controller, to the final controller. They'll be given another track distance miles to run, and that helps the pilot judge what altitude they need to be at. So just to be clear, that's what we call continuous descent approach. That's the type of profile we're talking about. And it requires teamwork between the air traffic controller at the National Air Traffic Control Center, which is on the south coast, the terminal controllers there, and the pilot. So why are those aircraft at those altitudes? It depends on the profile that the aircraft is flying, based on the pilot interpreting what they've heard from the controller. So the reason there is no fixed profile is that the pilot is manually descending the aircraft and flying headings applied by the controller to give them an optimum join, a join onto that instrument landing system, so the pilot can safely line up that aircraft. And then once they're on the ILS, they have what's called lateral and vertical guidance to help them reach the touchdown point safely.
Andy, thank you for that. Sorry, I'm just reading. Floods of questions came in then. Sorry.
Sorry, I can't see them.
May I speak, Sally?
No, Ivor, you can't. Sorry, not at the moment. Just
well, I have something relevant to say what Andy's saying.
Yes, no, two seconds, Ivor, just 2 seconds, because I've got to just be fair to the questioner for the original question. I think the point is why are they specifically flying over Southwater and Billingshurst? I think what's been implied is a built-up area. Andy, I think that's what they're asking in this question. I mean, your explanation was wonderful about how arrivals operate, but I think they're specifically asking why arrivals are flying directly over Southwood and Billingshurst between 4,000 and 6,000 feet. And I think, you know, to a little bit, we have to know what ILS means to everybody. I think it's final approach, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So it's from the threshold, the touchdown point of the runway, roughly. That's where the instrument landing system aims to get aircraft to touch down, and it fires out, if you like, from the runway all the way out into the approach. And like I say, the furthest out normally aircraft would join would be about 15 nautical miles. And in the day, the sort of inside joining point, the closest joining point would be about 8 nautical miles, and in the night period that's 10 nautical miles. I guess the point about the built-up area and the flying over, I think you're saying over lots of people rather than fewer people, is, I took that, Sally, yeah. So there is a radar maneuvering area which runs, if you like, east, roughly east to west through the airport, extends way out along those extended center lines, and then to the south of the airport. And within that radar maneuvering area, NATS controllers vector those aircraft in a way that safely sequences them for arrival. And there'll be a range of reasons why those aircraft are vectored in slightly different ways. So that radar maneuvering area has been there for quite some time. And what it doesn't do is it doesn't distinguish built up areas or areas or rural areas, in fact. So the controllers are thinking about safely sequencing the aircraft and giving the pilots sufficient information, if you like, to fly, if possible, the best continuous descent approach that they can do. But just to be clear, that controllers won't be really looking at, there are other specific circumstances, but they won't be looking at the differences between urban and rural.
Mm. Yeah.
In that situation, if that helps.
That's great. There's another one from Smallfield. Now, Smallfield is to the east of the airport, so westerly arrivals. They're directly under the glide. Why will Gatwick Airport not acknowledge the impact on the physical and mental well-being of these? And they're specifically talking about night flights, but I mean we can move on to night flights, but I think that's quite relevant to what you've been just saying about arrivals and how they approach. The next question is why do arrival jets or planes fly indirect routes routinely over the same small area of northwest of Crowborough, usually less than 4,000 feet. Now, we don't have concentrated routes yet on arrivals, but they're saying that they sound really loud. And again, they say also commenting about nighttime. So perhaps, you know, if you can just pick up those two points.
Yeah, are you happy if I start with kind of where I left off on the day, and then I'll switch into answering a bit about night, if that's okay. So yeah, it's the same point, if you like. The air traffic controller is providing headings to the pilot. The pilot is flying the altitude based on estimated track miles. And the reason that they're flying different tracks, so they're not always flying over the same track, is to provide separation between aircraft in front. Sometimes it will be to create a gap to allow an aircraft to take off from the runway, so it might not even be obvious. But the one thing I would say about radar vectoring is that it is within the confines of the radar maneuvering area, the sort of legally defined area that controllers operate those arrivals into Gatwick. It's pretty random. So you could see a pattern of traffic one day and have exactly the same number of flights and the same meteorological conditions and have a quite different distribution of traffic. So one of the things, so I'm not sure if this was going down the route of concentration or dispersal, if that's the right thing to pick up before I move on tonight, Sally. But one of the things that happened a few years ago was there was an independent review of arrivals at the Gatwick, and that was based on something that had happened to do with changing the instrument landing system joining point. So one of the things that review recommended was a reversion as far as possible to the original joining point. That wasn't possible at the time. The original minimum joining point to the RLS during the day was 7 nautical miles. And what the work did was originally it had pushed the joining point out to 10 nautical miles in a bid to support greater stabilization for the aircraft as it lines up on the extended instrument, extended runway center line on the instrument landing system. What that work did was it set in train a reversion to 8 nautical miles, which the Civil Aviation Authority accepted, still allowed the ability to deliver safe stabilization on that center line on the instrument landing system, but it didn't take it back to 7 nautical miles. So what that change, if you like, sought to do was emulate as much as it possibly could the distribution of traffic that had happened before that. It would, I mean, I've already mentioned traffic's random anyway, and that when you use that type of controlling methodology, but by going back to 8 nautical miles, it distributed more the arrival traffic. So there is greater distribution than there was when there was traffic joining between 10 nautical miles and 15 nautical miles. And what we do, we have done since that change was introduced, and what we continue to do today, is we monitor the distribution of traffic on those joining points between 8 and 15 nautical miles, or in fact, wherever they happen to be along there. And we provide that feed.
Smallfield is within that 8 nautical miles, is it? Because yeah. they're on the glide slope.
Yeah, so okay, I can pick that point up. But so we provide that data to NATS to provide NATS feedback to their control.
NATS are.
Oh, sorry, yeah. So NATS are the formerly known as National Air Traffic Services, but actually the moniker is now just NATS, but they are the national licensed air traffic service provider for the UK. So they provide services across the whole of the country, but specifically they have responsibility for terminal control in the London area. And that means providing those types of air traffic control services to the airports around London. So the point about joining inside 8 miles is it depends on whether the aircraft has captured the localizer, the bit of information that tells the aircraft where it is laterally. So the aircraft doesn't have to be bang on the center line. Once it's captured the localizer, it will also see the glide path. So the aircraft can descend and if you like, slowly join the extended center line. But we still provide that feedback to NATS. So we provide feedback on the entire distribution of traffic, including if they're inside 8 nautical miles.
Okay. So sorry, I'm just going to butt in here because I'm just trying to get some more questions in on this. And then we've got one about the holding stacks. And obviously that relates to arrivals as well. Because just before...
Did you want me to pick up on nights? Sorry, we were just...
We've got lots of questions coming in about nights. So let's just pick up and carry on with arrivals if you're happy with that. And there's a question from Burgess Hill about the overflight of Burgess Hill. And obviously, we have holding stacks, which you've kindly mentioned. They're talking about the howling noise and the nuisance, and it's worsening. And will it? I'll bring up that later. But what's response is pilots must be allowed to fly safely. So I guess the question here is, where does safe and impact on residents come into play? Because from the question, it seems that they're really suffering from the holding and from the arrivals coming to them.
So on the point about safety is absolutely paramount. The point about the holding stacks, so they are used, and they are used more than they should be. And I think you don't want me to go down the route of talking about airspace modernisation just yet, because we'll pick up in a separate bit. But one of the things that future work will do that we'll come on to will be changing how aircraft arrive. Not necessarily get rid of those holding stacks, but maybe not using them so much and putting them at a higher altitude and further away, maybe over the sea, which is what we would where we would like them to be, because we think they're less impactful. What I would say about the those holding stacks, well, in fact, I'll come back to it. When we come into airspace modernization, I'll come back to it.
All right, because there's another one from Curdford. Alistair in Curdford, and I've lived in this village for 5 years and noticed significant increase in flights overhead during this time into the past 12 weeks. Why are the flights over Curdford, a rural village, it's increased so much? Now that's further out than Smallfield and South.
Yeah, so it's difficult to answer specifics because, of course, you know, you would really need to look at track data. And maybe there's something, if I could take 2 minutes to talk about our system for monitoring tracks and the track data. Yeah. So, and some of the things that we've seen recently, it might be helpful. So if people haven't seen it, haven't heard of it, or haven't used it, we do have an online system that can be accessed through the Gatwick website called WebTrack. And we have a system which looks at track data. So it, if you like, uses radar data and another type of data to plot exactly where those aircraft over the ground. But we also have a series of over 20 noise monitors positioned around the airport, not at the airport, further away from the airport. And this system correlates the information from the track of the aircraft and the noise data. And you can interrogate it yourselves, if you like, by going onto the website. You can put in your postcode and it will give you lots and lots of different types of information about the overflight of your area. We have post-COVID, and I completely understand the reason why. I don't know if it's in this case at all. I certainly couldn't comment about that. But we've had lots of inquiries about the increase in overflights that people haven't noticed before. What's expected is that COVID was incredibly quiet. The airport was really heavily impacted, as you know, by COVID. So there was a significant reduction in flights, and it meant that the number of overflights that you all experienced and the amount of aviation noise reduced significantly for quite a long time, didn't it? And as the traffic has come back, and particularly over the summer, when it was probably at around 90% of the traffic levels that we'd seen in 2019, but significantly higher than we'd seen in 2021 and 2020, because people have become accustomed to those lower traffic levels, a lower frequency of overflight, we've had lots of people asking the question about the increase in the number of flights. So I can't actually say specifically in that case whether there is more, but what I would recommend is that people use the WebTrack system to take a look, and you can look at overflights, you can look at your house, and you can look at individual tracks or multiple tracks to see what that looks like. But coming back to the original point, Sally, about arrivals, it is random. The controller passing instructions to the pilot, and how the arrivals, what we call the arrival sway, that the aircraft are vectored onto that extended center line, is random.
Okay, so they're turned on to that final approach is random at present, and we'll come on to potential changes there. Now, I've promised to bring in Ivo. We're back. We lost him. He's an ex-pilot. So I'm just going to ask Ivo to just if you can be precise, Ivo, with your question to Andy, because it's always good to have an ex-pilot pick up on something we might have missed. So are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you loud and clear.
Yeah, I hear you, Cloudy Bear.
Andy, that's my phrase, Ivor.
Andy.
Hello.
What you failed to do was to explain about the continuous descent profile. I must tell viewers that it's aimed at minimum noise and minimum fuel burn. If the throttles are closed, the aircraft engines are quieter and are burning less fuel. Ideally, after leaving the stack, the throttles will be closed all the way down to 1,500 feet, and the pilot needs to increase power just for the landing phase. So you failed to mention that, Andy, but I hope that clears the point for the listeners, watchers.
Lovely. Thank you, Ivor.
Can I add to Ivor then? Sorry to take us off track. But you're right. That is a really important point, because there is a benefit to the airline in flying that really efficient profile, because like you say, that reduces fuel burn and it reduces noise. So one of the things that the airspace office at Gatwick does is it looks at the data we have from that noise and track keeping system that I was talking about earlier. And through that, we have, one of the tools we have is an airline noise performance table that looks at various bits of data, but one of them is that continuous descent approach. And the team look at the airlines that aren't performing as well as they might be, and they take that information and they meet directly with the airlines, and I've been familiar with this, with the sort of standards pilots on the airlines, and they talk to them about their performance data. And what we've seen over time, and the team do meet with a lot of airlines, is that once we've had that initial interaction and we're sharing the data, which we do with all of the airlines, we see a performance improvement. So I won't do it now, but I could rattle off a list of airlines whose performance has improved on the basis of that. So it's something, but because it's about the human in the loop, how the human acts, it's really important that we keep on top of that and keep, if you like, coaching the airlines on the basis of their performance. But Ivor's absolutely right. There's a benefit to the airline. It's really efficient and a real benefit from the noise perspective.
So they start their continuous descent at 7,000 feet now?
It depends. So the pressure setting will dictate the sort of base level of the hold. And what happens is when the aircraft pop out of the hold, they're on a different pressure setting. They pop the local pressure setting on, if you like, and they descend. So that can be from 7,000 or 8,000 feet. In the future, which I know I'm gagging to talk about it, but we will come to that at the appropriate moment. We would like it from a much higher altitude.
Okay, that's great to hear. Okay, I'm going to just ask some questions about departures.
Thanks, Ivor.
We've got some questions about departures. One is to the east of the airport. So it's flying down towards Seaford. So that is route 2. I think it was the old Seaford route. And it goes over Copthorne. And my son lives in Copthorne, and the aircraft are taking off from the bottom of his garden. I don't think that's quite literally, but very loudly day after day. Why do they seem to be using, or this is another question from somebody from Copthorne as well, why do they seem to be using this route continually? So that's one of the departure questions.
Okay, I'm happy to take that and answer that in the best way I can. So the way the departures work is that the airline, that particular flight, will file a flight plan, and they're allocated one of a number of departure routes from Gatwick, which is the most efficient to get them onto the route they want to go onto. What I can't say is whether the Seaford route is being used more than it was historically right now, but what we do is we publish, there's data on our website that will tell you exactly how often that's being used. But what I can say is the airlines have had to change how they fly across Europe because of the war in Ukraine. So it sounds odd to say that something that's happening thousands of miles away that could affect the patterns of flight across the UK. But the reason for that is the airspace over the Ukraine and across that entire area can no longer be used. So to get into the en route structure to fly to places that people want to, sometimes they have to change the way they're now flying. And if people looked at Flight Radar 24 or Plane Finder is the one that I use. If you look at that app, it's free to use, and you zoom out, you can see the massive, how busy a European airspace and UK airspace really is, but B, the massive hole in the airspace where there are absolutely no flights. So even though it seems like, you know, quite a long way away from the UK, things like the war in Ukraine can have a significant effect on how aircraft route. But I can't say whether that's directly related to Seaford, but it is wherever the airline wants to fly. We don't really have control over that. They'll fly the standard instrument departure route that's appropriate for the plan that they filed.
Is it because there's more European destinations?
It's possible, but like I say, often it's to do with, if I go back a couple of years, there were terrorist attacks in certain parts of Europe or in North Africa. Those things have a significant effect on demand and where people want to fly to. So one of the things that airlines do, obviously they're servicing a customer demand. Those sorts of things can have a really significant effect and change the pattern of life, if you like, in the airspace. Yeah. So I can't say whether it's to do with changes in European destinations, but we do, like I say, we publish that data, so it is available on our website how much those routes are used.
So we've got a couple of questions coming in from the north side. So route 3 and 4 departure routes. So we've got somebody who's lived there for 16 years, and there's the south of Horsham. They are now experiencing aircraft noise where they didn't before. We also have... why do the same people in Reigate and Redhill have to suffer Gatwick and Heathrow? It's certainly not fair and equitable. I live in Horsham. When I first moved, there were no aircraft over at all, but now night flights straight over my roof. So we're going on to night flights at the moment. And one from Rusper, you know, the planes are so low and every 20 seconds. So I think there's unhappy people to the north of Gatwick.
Can I explain a bit about that as well? So I know you know this, Sally, but maybe people there have been some changes to our westerly departures that we call Route 4. So they take off in a westerly direction and then they turn right and they do a sort of a looping 180 degree turn. And so they're tracking out to the east, but they go north of the airport towards Reigate and round to the east. So several months ago now, that route reverted to a route that's slightly more northerly. and there is currently an airspace change process in train in order to look at that route, because there were some historic issues about where it was and how it was handled. So in terms of Route 4, I can say that that airspace change process is in train. I'll come on to modernization later, airspace modernization, because that's a separate segment and how maybe that will change in the future. But just to be clear about sometimes why aircraft are lower than we would want them to be, and the airlines would want them to be, and you all want them to be. And that's because of the sort of really busy nature of the London airspace, and the fact that lots of these routes are intersecting one another. So the routes that depart Gatwick can travel to the north. So the ones that travel out to the west and turn right and do 180 degrees, or off our easterly runway, runway 08, and turn left 180 degrees, are roughly in the same place, if you like. They're not used at the same time, because obviously it depends on which way the wind blows, but they are generally flying over the same sort of areas right now. They're held at a lower altitude because there are Heathrow routes over the top. So unless an air traffic controller in the terminal control center with NATS is able to sort of tactically climb that aircraft, because they can see that there are no Heathrow aircraft in the way, aircraft are often held lower than they would want to be. So, and it's bad for the airlines because they burn much more fuel at lower altitudes. And it's bad for noise because it keeps the noise impacts closer to the ground. So, you know, we all agree that we want something done about that, but I'll talk a bit more about that later on.
Okay, I'm going to, there's one on go arounds, and it comes from a Crawley resident. So that's quite interesting. I have the misfortune to live on the side of Gatwick in Crawley, and have logged and complained about 25 go-arounds in the area since August this year. I mean, it seems to be increasingly common occurrence and unacceptable. Looking at the web tracking, which is what you were just talking about, there is often no apparent reason for the go-around. And Gatwick do not respond to my complaints here. And on the complaint system, there's another one, person saying, I haven't got time, I have to work to keep complaining about aircraft noise that I'm unhappy with. So I think one here is go-arounds, but also we can monitor and we can look at the planes over our house on your system. But what happens to our complaints? Two questions there for you, Andy.
So shall I start with go-arounds? Is that the... Yeah, so on the go-arounds, actually right now, we'll say September, they're not very much different than 2019. So in 2019, the sort of September figure was 0.59% of aircraft coming in did a go-around, and September 2022 is 0.54%. So they're roughly the same, although there are slightly fewer flights now, so that's a smaller percentage of a smaller number of flights. But it's worth saying the go-around procedure is a safety procedure. So you know, I'm sure Ivor would back me up here. It's really important that for whatever reason, if a pilot isn't happy with the approach, that she or he needs to be able to go around at any point on that approach. So it is a safety procedure. Now, sometimes it can be because there is an aircraft on the runway. We sometimes have wildlife on the runway. So, you know, a fox or something like that. There are all sorts of reasons for it. But it can just be that the aircraft isn't stable enough, that, you know, there's crosswinds. It could be the cabin's not secure. There are a whole host of reasons. But if I can just, before I come back to complaints, if I can just really quickly dip into something called the Noise and Track Monitoring Advisory Group. So we have a group, it's chaired by the head of the airspace office at Gatwick. It meets quarterly and it talks through these things. And one of the things that they talk through, as well as sort of lots of performance data, is specifically go-arounds. It's information we publish. And we are questioned on the go-arounds and the percentages of go-arounds against different categories. And just to be clear about the representation on the Noise and Track Monitoring Advisory Group, there are seven community facing members of the consultative committee from Gatwick that sit on that. So we are challenged on it. But just to be clear, there's quite a lot of scrutiny of that sort of data. But the go-around, going back to the go-around procedure, it's really important that pilots are able to use it, because it's a safety procedure to make sure that aircraft are kept safe at all times. The point about the complaint system, what happens to the complaints, how are they used? So actually, We do use complaints. We do reply to people. What we tend to do is reply to people with as much information as we can. If the issues that you raise are the same issues that you've raised all along and we don't have anything to add, we then will acknowledge your complaint. And it's important that that's really, that is recorded. That's recorded through the system, no matter which way your complaint is lodged. But we won't then reply on the same issues because we've given you as much information as we can. How we use the complaints, I mean, again, those are reported through the noise and track monitoring advisory group. They actually can be quite useful in some ways because we've identified issues. I don't know if I've got time, Sally, just to talk 2 minutes about a councillor from Lingfield that reported an issue to the noise and track monitoring advisory group. She talked about an aircraft that was making a strange noise. She even took a recording of that. On the basis of that recording, we isolated the sound from one of our noise monitors and did identify an issue with a particular type of aircraft, which we then reported both to the Department for Transport and the Civil Aviation Authority, but also to the manufacturer. And it turned out there was an issue with an engine on that type of aircraft, and there are now rectification measures in train to either retrofit aircraft that have that type of engine with that combustor issue, or for aircraft that will be rolling off the production line, I think from beginning of 24 or maybe the end of 23, they will have a new combustor on those aircraft. So just to be clear, we do use that information.
Okay, I think that, because the other thing is that the retrofitting of the A320, we have been seeing some planes that have been leased that haven't been retrofitted, which caused the real whining noise. I've just got...
Do you want me to pick that up as well? I can...
Well, I'm just going to touch on this. We've got another airline pilot asking questions of you. So you're feeling in the hot seat now. You've got lots of pilots lying.
As long as there's no air traffic controllers. If it's pilots and controllers, I'm in real trouble.
They're asking, why do you never use noise abatement procedure on departures as we use at noise-sensitive airports like Zurich?
Yeah, so the noise abatement procedure on departure, it depends what that means, but essentially there's some international guidance from the International Civil Aviation Organization that does set out that airports are to have at least two different types of noise abatement procedure on departure, and airlines are to have a choice of those two procedures when they depart, and those are called noise abatement Departure Procedure 1, NADP 1, and NADP 2. So we allow airlines to fly either an NADP 1 or an NADP 2. And it escapes me for now, but most of the airlines at Gatwick, I think, select NADP 1 because that's most efficient and most noise effective, but I couldn't say any more than that. So there is a legal requirement, actually, and the guidance from ICAO kind of sets that out, why airlines must be able to select one of two.
Okay, all right. There's quite a few sort of feelings that they're not quite convinced by the pandemic and the COVID answer to people.
I get that. No, I understand that.
Complaints more. And
Can I add to that as well? Sorry, Sally.
Well, let me just summarise and they
are
feeling a little bit sort of humoured because obviously noise is a major problem. And I just wanted to move on. We've spent quite a lot on that. I just want to move on to night flights because I certainly don't want to run out of time and then we can't ask really, you know, other things about the future because we're dealing with now. So let's have a look at night flights. They're causing huge disruption day and night with the impact on their sleep, the ability for people to do their jobs. So not only does it damage mental and physical health, it also impacts productivity. So all business that residents work for. I think, would Gatwick consider a night ban?
So that's a big question. I'll start with government policy and I'll come down, because one of the things that the sort of government and the Department for Transport has to do is they have to balance the sort of economic benefits and other benefits of night flights versus absolutely what you just talked about, which are the disbenefits of night flights, wherever they are. We're talking about Gatwick today. So the government does that. And on the basis of that premise, they have some restrictions in place for night flights at the designated airports, of which Gatwick is one. So we have a cap on the number of night flights that we can have in the summer and the winter. So we have roughly a 30 or a 31 week summer season, and then the rest of the year is called the winter season. So we have two limits across the year, but we also have a noise limit in the night period as well, based on the sort of certified noise level of aircraft that's added up over the season. And the purpose of those limits is to not breach either the noise limit or the number of flights. So the government did a consultation which ended about a year ago, and they published probably within the past year the outcomes of that consultation. There were some things that came from that, but what the government largely chose to do was roll over the existing night controls until October 2025, and they will reconsult from the, I think, roughly the end of 23, no specific date on that, about how noise controls might be tightened, but not just at the designated airports, across all airports. So what we do is we have a system in place to make sure that we stay absolutely within that cap, which is what we do. And we have a team that do that and work really closely with the airlines to make sure that happens. But we do some other things as well. So, for example, the government was going to introduce an operational ban on what are called QC aircraft. So essentially that's a noise certification level, roughly, QC4 being quite noisy, roughly a 747 type of aircraft taking off. But what Gatwick did was earlier, so last year we introduced that operating ban on not Boeing 717s, but QC4 type of aircraft. So they couldn't operate at Gatwick in the night period. We also do things like incentivize airlines to fly quieter aircraft by the way we charge aircraft that use the airport at night. So it's much more punitive to fly a noisier aircraft into the airport or out of the airport during the night period than if you're flying a much quieter type of aircraft, like an A321 Neo, which is a new engine option. So that's a newer, quieter type of aircraft. And we've got evidence that those sort of financial incentives worked. So in 2018, about 41% of the aircraft were those sort of newer types of aircraft. The structure of charges we introduced ratcheted up over time at the start of each financial year from 2018-19, over the subsequent 3 years, the noise charges. And by sort of that following financial year, the 18-19, over 70% of aircraft were those new engine options. But coming back, probably, Sally, to your point about airlines bringing in aircraft that aren't modified or aren't quieter. But so some airlines have done that, and they've needed to do that in order to support the schedule post-COVID. But just to be absolutely clear, if those aircraft aren't the quietest type of aircraft in the night period, they get charged significantly more, and particularly if they're not a modified Airbus to use the airport in the night period. Something like four times more.
So that's a no to a ban on night flights. I mean, I know it's not your decision, but at the end of the day, does Gatwick appreciate the issue of night flights and the impacts?
No, of course we do, and that's why we've introduced some of those things. But I should add, and it doesn't relate directly to the night regime, but specifically to the health impacts of night flights. So probably most people on the call won't be aware that the Department for Transport commissioned a research project to look at the health impacts of night flights and sleep disturbance specifically. So I'm not involved in that, but one of the things the Department for Transport wanted was lots of data about night flights and night noise. So the airspace office at Gatwick spent the past couple of months providing the DFT or the DFT research team with the data to inform that study. So yes, absolutely, we take it seriously, and we are supporting the Department of Transport to a great extent on that research study. We're not directly involved, but like I say, providing the data.
Do you think that local residents will get a chance to have input, or have they got to wait for the DFT consultation next year?
So in terms of the health impact study, I think that's in train now. So if people on this call are involved, I guess they will know we are not at all involved in that. On the consultation on night flights, DfT always welcome comments from all, and I'm absolutely sure that Cagney will be responding to that. So I guess people can feedback through you, but we also feedback on those consultations as well. But I would say to people, if you want to get involved, please do feedback to the Department for Transport. I'm not speaking on behalf of them, but that consultation will come next year.
Okay, all right. So I think night flights, it's an ongoing issue for us all. And it is one of the biggest bugbears. And I think frustration and frustration and lack of sleep. And I think there's lots and lots of echoes that are going on in the chat, because it's just one of the bugbears is night flights at Gatwick, because they're not urgent, they're leisure flights. So we're going to move on to question or section number three, which is the second runway. So this is Gatwick seeking to rebuild the emergency runway as a second runway. Gatwick refers to it as the northern runway. And I'm going to ask Dan Osborne just if he can unmute and if he wants to be seen, because he's put a question in the chat about the rebuilding of the emergency runway. And I think it would be good to hear Dan's voice, make a change for my voice. Are you there, Dan? No. Okay, I'll ask his question then, because he's obviously not there. With Gatwick seemingly on its knees post-COVID, should the airport be seeking a second runway with all the issues with climate change and impacts on climate and the pollution? And does the go-arounds and issues mean that the airspace is already too busy, and should you be seeking a second runway?
Gosh, there's a lot to unpack in there. Do you want me to leave the busyness of the airspace to airspace modernisation and just pick up on the the sustainability bits and the why Gatwick's pursuing the northern runway?
Yeah, I think the point that you make is that with a second runway, it will be flying the same routes as it flies today. So I think if you pick up on the other points, because then we'll come on to the modernisation of airspace, please.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, just to reinforce the point you've made, Sally, which is a really good point. So just to be clear, that the Northern Runway project doesn't require new routes. So all of the routes that the aircraft fly today will be the routes that will be flown in the future with the Northern Runway, unless airspace modernization happens in the meantime. But we'll come on to the details of that in a moment. In terms of Gatwick's plans, so there are a couple of things probably worth mentioning. One is about the forecast for growth in aviation. So those forecasting growth in aviation, whilst they, and bearing in mind that's passenger demand, you know, that's demand from the UK public, that demand remains. And so the sort of Department for Transport forecasts, the Eurocontrol forecast, so Eurocontrol is responsible for the management of airspace across Europe, a bit of North Africa and across the UK as well. They kind of manage the whole network. Those demand forecasts still remain really buoyant. So at the moment, those forecasts look like there is demand for air traffic. One of the things that the government has in place is a policy about best use of existing infrastructure. So that's an existing government policy, and it's been in place for a long time. So there's a difference between that policy and the government policy, which related to Heathrow's third runway, which I know isn't happening, or isn't happening at the moment anyway. So best use of existing infrastructure. So a number of airports are taking forward plans to use their infrastructure a bit more or in a slightly different way. So if you like, it's under the auspices of that, bearing in mind what the demand is telling us, that there is still a desire for that sort of capacity. Coming back to the point about sustainability. So some people will be aware that the government has a policy around net zero, so net zero carbon emissions by 2040. So Gatwick has and has had for at least a bit more than 10 years, a plan called Decade of Change. That looks at sustainability across a range of areas, one of which is noise, but also carbon. So if we use carbon as the, if you like, the easy proxy for sustainability. So Gatwick's Decade of Change will seek to drive the airport to net zero. My expectation is that the airport, the company, our owners will want to drive hard to beat, if you like, the government expectations on achieving net zero for the airport. So that will be the airport running. So just to be clear, that's the airport running at zero emissions. So that's things like our lighting coming from a renewable energy, our vehicles being electric, all those types of initiatives to make sure that the airport is zero emissions. Now, the difference here, just to expand that slightly, is that Gatwick's Decade of Change right now and the government net zero when it looks at airports doesn't necessarily cover the emissions of aircraft in the air. So, and I know we'll come onto it under airspace modernization, but aviation has plans and a roadmap for how you tackle carbon emissions. Some of that I'll tackle under airspace modernization. I don't want to knock Sally's agenda here, but part of it is around what you do with the aircraft and changes in technology. And I'd love it if you had an aeronautical engineer, Sally, here to talk about this a bit rather than me. But there are, if you like, there are kind of step changes in what aviation can do and aviation's plans. And there are plans around sustainable aviation fuel, which needs much more government policy support in order to, if you like, generate the right behaviours in industry and create a strong industrial base for the development of sustainable aviation fuel. There are initiatives around electric aircraft, so electric powered aircraft. What I can't do is really talk to, I've been asked questions in the past about what noise they generate. I genuinely don't know whether they're noisier or quieter, but what I can say is electric aircraft will probably be slightly smaller and probably be short haul or domestic for domestic flying. But I think where the focus of aviation is going in terms of being, you know, achieving net zero when you fly, and that's around hydrogen fuel. Now that's a much trickier technology to crack, and it will take a long time. So I think those first two are more likely to deliver in the sort of near medium term. Hydrogen requires changes to technology and to the ground infrastructure, quite a lot of change.
So some of the, I mean, probably outside your remit, but some of the questions coming in is that
your... Sorry, could I?
Sorry. So they're saying that your Decade of Change started in 2009. Is that correct?
I'm going to say 2010, but I haven't been as long as that, so it could be 2009. But we're on our second decade of change now. Absolutely, yeah.
So the emissions haven't changed; they've increased.
So airport emissions have come down.
But you're not responsible for arrivals and departures, not the aircraft taking off and landing. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but I'm happy to come on to that under the airspace modernization banner. I'll keep my powder dry until that point.
Yeah, no, because there's a question here is if aviation was paying tax on the fuel and that, would that help, you know, to get airlines to change? If you're not responsible for those emissions, would that help if the actual fuel was taxed and they paid that?
That would definitely be a question for airlines. The bit that we can influence in the future, less so now, are the routes or the routes that aircraft fly and the way they're flown. It's harder for us to do it now in the current situation, but it's something that we're much better able to influence under airspace modernization.
Okay, and one to take back to Tim in the office. So why is local access by bike and walking being stripped away? That's one to take back to Tim.
It's definitely well outside of airspace and noise, I'm afraid.
Okay. So, basically not happy on the chat, lots of greenwashing about net zero, not happy at all about the carbon emissions of a second runway. Lots don't support your second runway, I'm afraid, Andy. I know it's not yours personally. And a poor lady saying, I'm absolutely terrified of a second runway. And are you going to help me move house? Because it's just going to be unbearable. I think that comes from not just the aircraft, but it also comes from the lack of infrastructure and the congestion on the roads as well coming in here. from people. When a BA coming back to Gatwick, I don't know if that means ownership or in more flights. But
was BA. Actually, BA are already back. They've got a different airline called Euroflyer. So that's back at the airport. And actually, BA longer haul, so places like the Caribbean, they fly a slightly bigger aircraft. So they are still flying, and I'm sure some people on the call will know that, have experienced that.
Yeah, they're the noisiest ones. They're really low over Rusper. Sorry, I'm just going to dig in there for Rusper here, because they are the noisiest BA big planes. Anyway, second runway, consultation was appalling in the autumn, but it says there will be no impact on flight paths, particularly increasing noise over Maidenbough, Crawley. This would only be reviewed by the CAA in their later review. Can you confirm that the review will not take account of the second runway? Can you confirm there will be no additional noise over Maidenbough as a result from Max? I presume he lives in that area.
Is that in relation to the Northern Runway or to airspace modernisation? Because it seemed like...
It's the second runway. There's something, this would only be reviewed by the CAA. I think that must mean the modernisation of airspace for 16, because CAA have already approved the airspace for a second runway. But they want you to give them assurances, I think. Yeah.
And sorry, what was the first bit about the consultation? Sorry,
poor consultation in the autumn, that basically there's been poor consultation with residents. They don't feel they've been consulted properly in the autumn and in the spring.
Yeah, and so the spring consultation was about surface access, and I can't, about airspace and noise. That's not really something I could comment on. On the original consultation, which again is a bit outside of my area, but I can talk to it a bit if you like. So there were roughly 15,000 responses to that consultation, responses that related to noise and airspace. So individual comments from people. So actually, in terms of what we're talking about tonight, airspace and noise, actually it was quite rich with information from local people and industry and all the other people that were consulted. So actually there was lots of response to that. On the point about noise and northern, I'm just trying to unpick it in my head. I don't think I quite understand it. Sorry, Sally, that it's because it's the difference between the Northern Runway and airspace modernization. So like you say, for Northern Runway, the routes won't change, and the CAA have already kind of approved, if you like, notionally that change, because the routes don't change. But there will be more aircraft on those routes as they stand today. But if you project forward to potentially when the Northern Runway comes into being, and I know you've been keen to ask some questions about this recently, and I've touched on in relation to night flights, the proportion of quieter aircraft, that modern generation of quieter aircraft, will be much greater than we've got today. So when you look at the kind of noise impacts, there will be more frequent flights, but the bulk of those will be less noisy, if that makes sense. And I'll come on to airspace modernization separately about same routes and different routes. In relation to airspace modernization, there is absolutely a process, and the CAA would need to approve any changes. It's a really complicated process. We've done lots of engagement so far, but I'll come on to that in a moment. Sorry, because I don't want to go on.
That's right. Is the second runway a done deal then?
No. So at the moment where we are, we're still working through the process, actually. So there's still, from an airspace and, well, from a noise perspective, there's still lots of engagement ongoing with local authorities, and that's going to continue for the next few months, actually. The expectation is that the development consent order, the submitting the plan, if you like, will happen in spring 2023, so the end of Q1, I guess, beginning of Q2 next year. So it's for sure not a done deal, but it does sit, as I said earlier, within the sort of government policy around use of existing infrastructure.
Okay, so just a few comments here. Gatwick came round several places, including K2 in a burger van with a few brochures and people unable to answer questions. more frequent flights, more noise pollution. Not very, very happy on that one. So let's move on. You keep hinting to the modernisation of airspace is going to be the be all and end all.
Sally, can I please speak just for a moment, please?
Go on, Ivor, then.
Okay. I'd like to question the logic of this second runway, runway 26 right, Andy. You're going to increase the capacity for departures. Yeah? Only departures on that runway, yes?
On that runway, yeah, that's right. Well, on that runway, when it's used together with the main runway, when it's used as it is today, then it would be both.
Yeah, so you have more capacity for takeoffs than you do have for landings. So how do you square that?
So there'll be more landings on the main runway. So the main runway.
But aircraft can't actually use the two runways at the same time because of the lack of wingtip clearance.
So yeah, that's either that's part of what will happen with the construction as part of the plan. So, and you'll know this, so I'll describe this to you and hopefully people will understand it. If you can imagine that an aircraft is lined up to take off on the northern runway and there is an aircraft on approach to land on the main runway, you wouldn't normally be able to do that.
You won't be able to land.
Yeah, yeah. So the aircraft will land, and when it's touched down and under control, the aircraft on the northern runway will be able to take off. So that, if you like, slightly increases.
On the landing roll, the aircraft on 26 left will be overtaking the one on 26 right, and you won't have the wingtip clearance.
Yeah, so this is a system that's used in other places. Like I say, we're stepping a bit outside of airspace and noise, but this system is used in San Francisco for similarly separated runways and Berlin Tegel. So the International Civil Aviation Organization guidance allows that between instrumented and non-instrumented runways. So that already happens in other places.
I put it to you that if you have more capacity for takeoffs than you do landings, aircraft will be stacked up over the channel waiting to land. And airlines like EasyJet, who are trying to fly three departures a day per aircraft, will end up landing late at Gatwick after 11 o'clock at night. And so gradually I see Gatwick becoming a 24-hour airport.
Can I just to be clear, Ivor, no. So the balance of arrivals and departures will remain the same. There'll just be more departures off the northern runway and lots more landings on the main runway. So they will obviously be the same number.
So overall, there will be no increase in departures.
Yes, there will be. There'll be lots of departures off the northern runway, some off the main, but lots of landings on the main runway.
I put it to you that aircraft will be stacked up over the channel like we used to be in the 80s.
Okay.
Can I add something on the stacking point, Sally, which is completely separate? Or are we running out of time?
Okay, right. So let's just that's bringing us really onto modernisation of airspace. And thank you, Ivor, for challenging Andy there. That was a good intersection there. We've got things saying, why is Gatwick not listening to the Davis report? That was the Airport Commission report, the government commission, which found in favour of the third runway. I think it's true to say that the emergency runway or the northern runway would have to be rebuilt 12 metres north to enable you to use the two runways concurrently. I think that's probably what Ivor was discussing there, just to clarify that. So I'm going to move on. We've obviously had questions in about ghost flights and things like that. I'm going to move on to modernisation of airspace. Now, modernisation of airspace is called something like FASIS, Future Airspace Strategy Implementation South. It means the redesigning of the airspace. And for us, it really involves Gatwick sitting below Heathrow flight paths. We've got Farnborough private airport to the west of us, and then we've obviously got Stansted and Luton to the north of us. So Gatwick's going to play its role in the modernisation of airspace, and obviously one of the major concerns is that Gatwick is progressing through Civil Aviation Authority's CAP 1616 consultation process, and they're currently in stage two. And one of the major concerns is that the airspace is going to be redesigned. Now, Cagney did raise this the other day in promoting this event, and we were knocked back by Gatwick Airport. And so we conducted a survey with local estate agents, and we asked them, is a house overflown by aircraft cheaper than a house that's not overflown by aircraft? And out of the six we asked, five were clear. Yes, a house that is overflown by aircraft is cheaper than a house that is not overflown by aircraft. And the reasons they gave is that a house will have less demand, and so it will reach a lesser figure. And it will be like a house that's built next to a busy road or a traveller's site. It's not as valuable. So I put it to you, Andy, is modernisation of airspace something that residents should be scared of? Should they be looking to move house now? And that is one of the questions that came up in the chat. They are very scared of what it's going to do to their rural villages and their rural area and lifestyle. And will you be paying for them to move house? Over to you.
Thank you. There's a lot of things to unpack there. And I understand the strength of feeling on this, as well as the things about the current operation. Can I just provide a bit of context just for 2 minutes about where this comes from? Because I know some people on the call are really familiar with it and some people aren't. So the airspace modernisation strategy is a UK-wide government-sponsored strategy. It's got 15 initiatives that cover a whole host of things, from the integration of space flight into the UK, as well as what Sally just mentioned, which was FASI South, which is Future Airspace Strategy Implementation of South. And it's essentially the modernisation of airspace over the south of England. And there are kind of complementary initiatives for the lower airspace in the north of England and upper airspace. And like I say, all sorts of things are included in the airspace modernization strategy. In support of that, so that's, if you like, a CA strategy, the government passed a bill through Parliament, became an act in May 2021, which was the Unmanned Aircraft and Air Traffic Management Act. And essentially that said, there is this national program, sponsors are to take part, and if you don't take part, you'll be sanctioned. And I won't bother going into what the sanctions are. So just to be clear, this is a government-sponsored driven program, but for good reason and with good intent. So Gatwick is one of 20 airports involved, and the national air traffic services provider that's licensed by the UK government, NATS, is also involved, and they have to change an awful lot of airspace at sort of medium and higher altitudes. So that's the kind of context. I think I understand people's concerns in some respects, in that when we talk to people about airspace modernization, there are lots of concerns about what the new technology might mean in terms of impact, and that the central premise originally of airspace modernization was about an increase in capacity, and the government strategy, and it also produced a document called the Rationale for Airspace Modernization. The central premise around increasing the capacity of the airspace over the UK wasn't necessarily just about increasing capacity to meet demand. It was also because UK airspace is incredibly busy and incredibly complex. And Ivor just mentioned something about holding, like the 1980s. Well, Ivor, there's loads of holding that happens now in the airspace because it's nowhere near as efficient as it could or it should be. So air traffic controllers tactically intervene in the system to make it more efficient than it might have been. But you need a system-wide change in order to deliver system-wide benefits. So the government's central premise of delivering capacity has lots of other benefits with it, if you like. So resilience is one, environment is one. And when I say environment, I'll focus on carbon and noise. So there are a raft of benefits that will be delivered. But the two things I guess I hear, well, one more than the other, is about the increase in traffic, which won't necessarily be driven by airspace modernization itself. The increase in traffic will be driven by demand in the UK and through airport utilisation and the plans that airports probably put forward over the next 10 to 20 years. So you will probably find that under the auspices of the government's making best use policy, which is different to the Davis report and like I said about the Heathrow third runway, that there will be plans for airports to increase capacity, and they will use the airspace. But be clear, the airspace is not expected to be filled. It's expected to be resilient and efficient and effective, and therefore from a carbon perspective be more efficient, and from a noise perspective be more efficient. So if I use some examples that I picked up earlier from people's feedback, the one about departures being really noisy and too low. So one of the things we fully expect to unlock here is something called continuous climb. So right now, I mentioned earlier that departures from Gatwick are stopped unnecessarily low because of conflicting routes from other airports, predominantly to the north, that's Heathrow. So one of the key benefits that we would get, I think, is this idea of continuous climb for airlines. So that doesn't necessarily mean that there's an increased amount of thrust from the aircraft. That's not what this is about. This is about not stopping aircraft at 3,000, 4,000 or 5,000 feet. This is about allowing aircraft to continuously climb beyond 7,000 feet. Beyond, if we had our way, we'd have them keep going all the way up. We don't know if that's realistic given the sort of complexity and intensity in the London airspace particularly. So that's one of the things that would certainly be unlocked. One of the other points that was mentioned earlier, there was somebody had mentioned about the holds and the noise in the hold, which may not just be to do with aircraft in the hold, could be to do with aircraft using air brakes to slow aircraft down and things like that. But one of the things that we have asked NATS to do, because NATS will be responsible for designing airspace sort of above 7,000, maybe 10,000 feet, is we've asked for things like the holds not to be too close to the airport. If they could be at a higher altitude, which is better for the airlines because you use less fuel at a higher altitude, the noise impact, or it's less impactful if those aircraft are at higher altitudes. But we've also asked if they could be pushed further out from the airport. Over the sea would have been a preference. I don't know what will be possible, but there are a number of benefits from this. But I understand the nervousness because people often talk about satellite-based navigation, which is a key technology that will be delivered through this process. And one of the things that people have talked about in terms of satellite-based designed routes is that they can concentrate aircraft. And it's a piece of feedback that we receive time and time again. So I understand why people have a concern about concentration. But one of the things that we will need to figure out, all of industry, we're in collaboration with local stakeholders and others, is how do we manage that? How do we, if people want dispersal, how do we do that if that's what people want?
Andy, I'm just going to inject them. Sorry, because there's a few things coming.
Sure, yeah.
So does that mean that the holding stacks won't be over the sea now? So will that be over new people, holding stacks?
No, we'd like them to be able to see. I don't know. It's part of the NATS consultation. So we will design up to, at the moment, it looks like 7,000 feet. Mm. But so the holds aren't, although they're Gatwick holds, they're not part of the Gatwick design. So what we've done is we put a series of requirements into NATS, to help inform them. As you said, we're at a relatively early stage of the process, so there's a long way to go, and there'll be a full public consultation on all of this. So we've asked NATS to do that, but we don't have control over where they'll be, and there will need to be a consultation and assessment of the optimal place to put those.
So when will the public be involved in this process? Because, as I said in my intro, you're already at stage two. So when will the general public have their say and actually get to see these flight paths that you're designing?
Yeah, so at the moment, we're way off, be clear about this, we're way off finalising flight paths, a long, long way away. We've been running a series of engagements through this year. A full public consultation is not likely to happen until 2024 for Gatwick. And the reason, just to be clear about the reason for that, and that is because it's in ordinary circumstances, if we were following, and Sally mentioned it earlier, the CAA guidance around airspace change, that's called the CAP 16-16 process. Ordinarily, you would be following that airspace change process in isolation. This is a multi-stakeholder airspace change. It's incredibly complex because of that, and you have to understand that you're introducing a change and there is another change happening at an airport next to you. So you need to understand the implications of that and understand the cumulative effect of those changes as well. That's really important that when we go out and we start to explain to people what's happening, that we understand and you understand what those cumulative effects are. So at the moment, the plan is, and my expectation is, that that wouldn't happen before 2024. But because it involves multiple stakeholders, this is really complicated. Heathrow is our nearest neighbour, is a really big, complicated, busy airport. There is a chance that that timeline itself could slip, but that doesn't mean that our process is more developed. It just means it's taken us longer to get to that point of a full public consultation.
So why does airspace planning not make any allowance for ambient noise, but simply chooses to fly over less people, i.e. small villages with low ambient noise?
I can answer that. I can give a couple of bits to that answer. So one thing is when the impacts of noise are assessed, and particularly the health impacts, it looks at numbers of population. Absolutely. And that's kind of the way the government policy kind of looks, but also the tools that the Department for Transport have in place for assessing transport projects, including airspace. So that's particularly about that point. But actually, when it comes to designing the airspace and we follow the airspace change process, you do have to build a body of evidence to prove why you have elected, excuse me, for the option set that you have come out with as your favoured option. So one of the things that we'll be looking at through this process is community feedback directly through the airspace change process itself. But we'll also be launching a project to look at something called, and maybe this isn't the best title, I will grant you, Fair and Equitable Distribution of Air Traffic. Now, that will directly engage with local stakeholders in order to understand their views about traffic and its impacts. So it'll be for people to explain their views about that. And there'll be a whole host of things that people want to share and that will come from that. And it will be, you know, a part of our challenge is how does industry adapt to that? So if people want concentration and the fewest number of people to be overflown, then that takes you back to that rural setting question you was talking about. If people would prefer distribution of traffic, industry have to figure out a way of designing routes that create distribution in an environment that uses satellite-based navigation for the design of those routes. So it ultimately will depend on what people want, and us building an evidence base to support that as well. That will be really important.
Okay, so as we're sort of running low, one of the points is that we're going to have motorways above our home. We've already seen departures with PRNAV, so concentrated routes introduced in 2014. Are we going to see concentrated routes on arrivals the same as we have on departures? Are you going to remove noise preferential routes on departures that we currently have, which protect some people from being overflown? And how can they engage in this process when the consultation today on the second runway has been so poor? What guarantees do they have that their voices are going to be heard with this modernisation of airspace? Because obviously some of the people on this call today are not currently overflown and some people are currently overflown. So there's a number of questions there, but they're flooding in the, they're obviously very worried.
I understand why some people might be concerned. So I'll pick up with voices to be heard. I'll do departures, then arrivals, if that's okay, just in that order. So voices to be heard is a really good point. That is part of the full public consultation. But something that I didn't cover in the explanation of the sort of setup and the context for airspace modernization is that the government set up an organization called the Airspace Change Organizing Group, ACOG. And the role of ACOG is to coordinate all of those different sponsors' airspace changes and to help bring them together. Now, one of the things that ACOG will be doing early next year, again, I don't want to speak on their behalf, but roughly March 23 is a national and regional public engagement exercise. So, and that will be looking at airspace modernization. So I think there's a, that will be well ahead of any Gatwick consultation, so to be clear. And that will be a public consultation about things like cumulative effects, which I know is something you're really interested in, Sally, how to engage with the public, that sort of thing. So ACOG will be seeking people's input through that public engagement exercise, which right now is scheduled for March 23. Going back to the point about departures, 2014 change, NPRs, just to be clear about the departure changes to Gatwick's departure routes. So one of the drivers for that originally was the switching off and the removal of legacy navigation aids, which are largely around something called, well, we'll just call them legacy navigation aids, because I don't want to go into explaining acronyms at this stage. Those things are being reduced from service today, and there is a national program to do that. They don't belong to Gatwick, they belong to NATS, and they are being removed and switched off. So one of the reasons for converting from the old conventional style navigation design routes to this satellite-based design back, not quite 10 years ago, but almost, was in order to mitigate the issue that those things would be removed and then you don't have routes to fly. But one of the disadvantages back in 2014 was that, unlike when airspace modernization happens and all of the airspace change sponsors will be looking to change their routes, hence I made the point earlier about the ability to deliver continuous climb on departure, is that that wasn't possible in 2014. So some of the things that happened in 2014, there was some satellite-based navigation was introduced, but the ability to continuously climb was not, because none of the other routes in the London airspace had changed. So that will be one significant noticeable difference. When it comes to noise preferential routes, and sorry, I'm skipping on, Sally, because we've got 5 minutes, is that one of the things that the CAP 1616 airspace change process requires us to do in airspace modernization is, if you like, start with a blank sheet of paper. So we have to look at a range of options. And when we look at options and option sets, we tend to look at a set of departures off our westerly runway, a set of departures off our easterly, a set of arrivals for our westerly, and keep going like that. So you end up with multitudes of option sets. Now, as we go through this process, we can look at what the best options look like, and we're engaging as we go through that. But when we talk to people, if everybody said to us, we would like you to leave the routes exactly where they are today, that is absolutely something that's there or thereabouts designable using this satellite-based navigation. But people, you know, and this is people's opportunity to speak, will they be heard? Absolutely, they'll be heard. Likewise, if, you know, for example, everybody said, we would like you to somehow create dispersion in a particular area or not dispersion in a particular area, that's absolutely part of the engagement process. So those things would happen through the airspace change process, and also to an extent through this study that will be looking at fair and equitable distribution of air traffic. On the point about arrivals, because we want to talk about arrivals just very quickly. Sorry, I realise I am galloping through this. So the technology to deliver the departures using satellite-based navigation is fairly well established. For arrivals, it's much trickier. So one of the things that our Noise Management Board has discussed, and it's got a project for, is something called the Reduced Night Noise Trial. And that is about designing arrival routes based on satellite-based navigation. One of the reasons we've chosen to conduct the trial in the night period is because it's lower intensity in terms of traffic levels. So we know that we would be safely able to introduce that trial in the night period. One of the benefits of using that type of technology is that we talked about continuous descent arrival earlier and why there's a variation in the altitude of aircraft. One of the real benefits of designing satellite-based navigation arrival routes is that you absolutely design in a lateral profile, but you also design in a vertical profile. So you're able to design in an optimized noise vertical profile for every route. One of the challenges of that is that in order to distribute the traffic fairly across a whole swathe, is that you need to design lots and lots and lots of those routes for each runway. And at the moment, the jury's out, and you know, I haven't seen the evidence yet of how you're able to do that in a way that aircraft flight management systems, the computers on the aircraft, are able to take in all that information on all the various routes. And the reason for that is that the aircraft that are flying around need to have lots of data on them, because although they, for example, they might start out flying to Gatwick, they might fly somewhere else. So they don't just need the Gatwick arrival routes in there. They need to be able to access a database that has lots of other routes on it. So it's possible and even likely that to start with, the arrivals part of airspace modernization will be similar to what we have today, in the sense it's a controller talking to a pilot. Sorry, I'll stop there because I can see you want to interrupt me.
Yeah, I do, because I'm just getting lots and lots of things coming in, because obviously we're running out of time. And I think that the feeling is that there is a lot of sadness and a lot of concern out there. And that unfortunately, ADCOG is headed up by Mark Swan, who signed off the departure concentration. And so there's not a lot of hope. The problem is that the consultations and a lot of aviation is full of jargon that people don't understand, and the concern is that they want to get out now before you achieve your second runway or the modernization of airspace, because they're very concerned they could be facing new flight paths over their rural homes. I think that's basically what's come out of it. But there's also lovely comments saying, thank you, Andy, for putting your head above the parapet. You know, it's the first time that we've actually had somebody to talk to us about airspace, and it is a complex subject, and this is why it's very difficult, and CAGNY does its best to break down the jargon, because it's important people know about what's going on. And I think the plea is that Gatwick must be transparent in this and to take on board the concerns of communities. And it's not just those overflown, it's those that are now waking up to potentially what could be, which we obviously experienced in 2014.
Just on that point, and sorry, I don't want to overstay my welcome, but that absolutely the process requires us to consult with people who are or may be affected by any change. So absolutely it's a requirement to do that. And you can expect us to do that. I hope I've been able to explain it without too much jargon tonight, Sally, and that people have been able to hold on to the conversation. I've done my best to try and do that.
No, and we, as I say, we really thank you for taking on our challenge to come along this evening. Much appreciated. And it's obviously provided people with a lot of information to think about. And if there is any jargon that you didn't understand from today, can you please go to our website? There is a jargon buster there, and this will be recorded and it will be on our YouTube channel, hopefully by tomorrow morning. So you can go back and listen to it carefully if you wish, and really understand some of the what was described, etc. So I'm going to close the meeting here, say a huge thank you to Andy. Thank you to everybody who's attended this evening. We have been inundated. I've tried to pick up as many questions as I possibly can to you, and ask and put Andy on the spot a bit for you. We will be hosting some more climate change events to coincide with COP27. So please to stay sort of aware when you get our emails. And we promise to keep you up to date with everything going on at Gatwick Airport and with all the developments as we have to date. So, Andy, thank you ever so. Thank you, everybody, and good night.
Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Bye-bye.